Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I feel so strongly about the use of force against innocent people that I can sympathize with why you would say it's, we got to execute this guy for what he's done to this poor woman or this poor child. Hello and welcome to the 35th episode of Varvet International. And as far as my name and so on, it's business as usual. I'm still Kristoffer Triumph from The Block in Sweden. If you just look at following in social media, today's guest might be the most famous to date. Mr. Mark Pellegrino has nearly 330,000 followers on Twitter. And no wonder, he is a great actor with many great movies and TV shows on his resume. I mean, on TV, he was on The Returned, Lost, Supernatural, and Dexter, for instance. And he's been in movies such as The Big Lebowski, Capote, Mulholland Drive, and National Treasure. In short, he's had a fantastic career. However, we won't talk much about that at all. See, following him on Twitter, he is very much about politics. And even though I personally am very far, far to the left of him when it comes to politics, we had a great time and we will eventually get into his life as well. So, without further ado, let's roll the tape, please.
Actually, my grandfather was full Swedish.
He was.
Yeah, Lester Felting was his name.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so I've got a lot of Swede in me.
Yeah, all right, but I thought you were like 100% Italian.
No, my dad is Italian, my mom, Swedish.
All right, yeah. Okay, cool. Is that important to you with the ancestry and so forth?
I mean, no, not in that I don't take any pride in that kind of thing, for sure. I only take pride in things that I accomplish, but it's just an interesting thing to think about. Since I didn't really know my father, I feel like I have a desire to know where my roots are.
Okay.
Even if the idea of ethnicity means nothing to me. Yeah. Just knowing where I came from and knowing what my ancestry did is kind of fascinating to me.
Tell me why you never knew your father.
You know, it's complicated. You know, I don't even know all the reasons around it. I've just started to connect with people from his side of the family. And, you know, they have their version of events. And my mom, before she passed away, had her version of events. And from my mom's point of view, they just were incompatible with each other, you know, and fought a lot. They were young. My mom was in her early 20s, 23 when she had me. And they just didn't get along, and he had to go his way and she had to go hers. And then he got involved with another woman, married her, had a family with her. And when my mom, I guess, started dating another man, and that man became a prominent feature of our life, my real father decided to, this is according to him, take a, you know, a back seat. He thought he was causing more damage than doing good by being in my life, so he decided to take a step back. Very odd conclusion for a father to come to, but that's the one he says, that's what he says he, that's what he says he thought.
Is he still around?
No, he passed away about 4 years ago.
Both of your parents must have died fairly young then.
Yeah, right? My mom passed away when she was 56.
Why?
Lung cancer. She stopped smoking when she was 30. I got her to quit smoking, and she became pretty healthy. She ran 2 miles every day and ate basically well and took care of herself, looked fantastic, and died anyway of lung cancer.
Okay.
And my father, I actually was there at his deathbed when he passed away. He passed away in Las Vegas. He had prostate cancer that spread to his bladder and then kind of metastasized all over. But he was a smoker and a drinker all the way through his life.
Okay, wow. You must have become motherless at what age?
In my 30s, I think 33. I was okay. In 98, yeah.
How was that?
Disturbing. You know, my mom was the only family that I felt like I had. My grandfather was the only male figure in my life that I could really identify with, and he passed away when I was 15 from cancer as well.
Uh-huh, right.
And so she was sort of an anchor for me and a friend, you know, and a very supportive light in my life. And to have her go was really, really devastating.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, okay. But you learn to cope with it, of course, after a while. But
yeah. I mean, you adjust and you sort out ways to deal with that information, I guess. And it was hard for a while, for the first year. Death is such a crazy phenomenon because you cannot adequately understand it in your conscious mind. So the absence of a person means they have to be somewhere. It's not that they're obliterated or gone, which they are, in my view. I don't have any religious ideology. So for me, once you're gone, you're gone. And that's nearly an impossible thing for the consciousness to grasp, I think, since consciousness deals with what is and what exists and not with non-existence.
Yeah, exactly. It's like trying to wrap your head around eternity or space.
Yeah. I mean,
when people tell me that the universe is expanding, I'm like, well, into what?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It's everything that is. So what can it expand into? Those are very interesting theories to wrap your head around.
Yeah. Perhaps if I did acid, I would...
suddenly connect with whatever that means.
Exactly. But I wouldn't go that way anymore. Anyway.
You've been there before.
Well, yes. I've been sober for 11 years now. Mm,
congratulations.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, that's quite a feat.
Yes. You seem like a really healthy person, but can you deal with alcohol and so forth?
Yeah, I have my issues from time to time with it. I've used it to medicate in the past, but I have control over it. I can decide when I do it and when not to do it, and so I don't have the horrible addiction that so many people do, where it's kind of beyond their will, I guess. So for me, it's a pleasant diversion. And because I'm, more or less health conscious, I can only do it to a certain extent because I don't want to hurt myself. So I'm not bent on destroying my mind or my body as so many people who are victims of that do.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I could also decide whether to indulge in alcohol or not, but once I took the first beer, it was out of my hands.
Sure.
So I guess I'm an alcoholic by definition then, but it's sort of tricky for me to still to this day. It's tricky to sort of admit that to myself.
Sure. There's no shame in it though, and you can admit it in public like right now, which is
absolutely yeah
that's a fantastic step in my mind.
I would assume that American young people in general oftentimes are... would you say that it's more usual that people drink first or do they take a joint first?
Mm. Nowadays, I don't know, since I think our culture is more and more accepting the idea of people smoking marijuana than they did in the past. So it might be neck and neck. And as far as availability, it's probably becoming more available since I think there's a couple of states that have legalized it.
And California is about to, or?
California has legalized the medicinal distribution of marijuana, but they're at odds with the federal government, of course. One of the things that I agree with, you know, people should be free to indulge if that's what they want to do. It's their body and their lives, and as far as I'm concerned, nobody should interfere with that. So, you know, I think at one time in my era, it was probably beer first, you know, or some version of alcohol, and then a step or two away, you might experiment with something else. Now they're neck and neck, I think.
Yeah. I was reading up on your tweets, sort of.
Yeah.
Are you what you would call a libertarian?
I wouldn't call myself a libertarian, but that's the closest political party that I could identify with, but I wouldn't call myself that. I'm a classical liberal, and no party exists that I actually identify with. And the libertarian, where I take issue with the libertarians is their inability to morally defend the free market, and in their sense, if you're a consistent libertarian, that government has absolutely no place in the lives of people. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I think it does. It's just a specific function. It serves a specific function in a civilized society. And so I argue with my libertarian friends all the time about that kind of stuff.
What do you think that the government should focus on?
Well, the government is force. And I think that force should only be used in a retaliatory capacity. I think that human beings, in order to be civilized, have to ban the use of force in interpersonal relationships, because force is the way you violate someone's rights. And rights are a freedom of movement, freedom of action. You think the evidence of your senses tells you that a course of action is so. Nobody should force you from taking that course of action, unless, of course, you harm another person. If you harm another person, then force is required in a retaliatory sense. If I think I want your apartment and I knock you on the head and take it away from you, I'm a criminal. And then the government steps in as a repository of objective law and due process, taking the emotional elements out of retribution for a crime and putting it totally in the realm of reason, and then punish that person according to a process, a logical, methodological process of proof, and then making that person pay in some way or another. So,
but in your dream society, when you knock me in the head to get this apartment, what would happen to you after the trial in the Pellegrino society?
Well, I would imagine I would have to go to jail and pay retribution. I think that my time in jail would be, I would probably be put to work paying you back for the damages that I caused you. That would be my ideal world.
Yeah. Okay, but the fact that, I mean, we do put people in prison all over the world, and at least in Sweden, that's where criminals really learn how to be a criminal.
Well, I think that the prison system operates according to a very different notion of the causes of crime and the solutions to crime than I do, personally. First of all, I know in America, I don't know the exact figures, but 70-80% of the inmates in American prisons are there for drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses. So, and in my world, transactions between two consenting adults are legal. Whether you agree with them morally or not, they're legal, because, you know, it's the responsibility of the people in the midst of the transaction to deal with each other as they see fit. So from my point of view, 80% of those people shouldn't be in prison. And for violent offenders, it shouldn't be a system that enables you to take steps up the social ladder. In other words, if crime isn't just a problem of character, antisocial behavior, but a societal issue, and society is to blame for it, and prison becomes a type of therapy that you kind of reintroduce yourself back into the community, which it isn't. The recidivism rate is so high, it's proven, in my view, that way of looking at crime is incorrect. You basically do teach criminals to be better, more apt criminals, in that they go into a system where they're moving up the social ladder, they're getting benefits and therapy that they manipulate, they don't have to pay back the person that they've stolen from, they're more or less moving up the economic ladder, in a sense. They get three hots and a cot, and they have no sense of what their crime has done to the individual. And I think if we made it that it was punishment for what you've done, and that your object is to repay the person that you've harmed. And in the case of a life, if somebody took a life, there's no way they can repay that, in which case I have feelings about that as well. But if prison were a punishment, I think people would be less inclined to go there. I actually knew somebody who got out of prison because I box, so I go to boxing gyms, and boxing gyms are kind of, you know, they're a little bit inner city, you know, and people that populate the gyms have a tendency to have records. And this guy loved prison. Uh-huh. He'd just gotten out of 6 years. He wanted to go back. He could get anything he wanted there. Loved it. And I don't think prison should be a place you love. I think it should be a place where you feel shame for what you've done to another human being.
How about death penalty in the Pellegrino universe?
Yeah, classical liberals have a tendency to be against the state, or at least libertarians don't like the idea of the state controlling anything. So the idea of the state having power over your life is particularly distressing to them. For my part, it's not necessarily a classical liberal tenet. A classical liberal tenet, from my point of view, and there are probably people that dispute me tons, but I think if you've taken a life, that you've taken hope and dreams of a person, that person can't draw another breath. They have nothing. You've shattered their families, lives, their loved ones, who will never be the same from that time on. And so, in my opinion, the death penalty is appropriate for somebody who has taken a life, provided that case has gone through due process of law and an appeals process, not the absurd appeals process that we have today, where minutiae is disputed on testimony, things that don't pass muster, but just keep the case in a continual state of appeal so that the person never meets the just end, or, you know, after 25 years, finally get what they deserve, which is an end that is far more just than the victims, because that poor victim didn't get due process. They didn't get legal review. They didn't have supporters behind them trying to save their lives. They were just alone and victimized by somebody.
So you believe that a human life is sort of the most valuable thing on earth?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
Yeah.
I love human beings.
All right. So, for instance, if there's a, what's it called? Like it's a sexual offender or a child abuser?
Yeah.
When that person comes out of prison now, they have to sort of knock on the door in the neighborhood, and they're going to be sort of stigmatized for the rest of their lives, right? Do you think that works?
Yeah, I'm unclear. I've never seen any statistics as to whether that works or not, but I do know a little something, and maybe a little bit of knowledge is worse than not knowing anything at all, but I don't think that child molesters are reformable. I think they're extremely dangerous and manipulative and will, if left to their own devices, find a way to get what they want. And rapists may have very, very similar unreformable character issues, unless it's approached from a specific point of view. And I'm referencing a book that I read that I think kind of changed my outlook about crime and about the mindset of criminals. It's called Inside the Criminal Mind by Dr. Stanton Samanow. He was one of the only doctors who worked within the prison system to actually reform criminals. But he did it by breaking all the myths of criminality that we know of, like poverty causes crime and there's such a thing as a crime of passion. All of these things are myths. When you break down the criminal personality, the criminal person has always been antisocial. There's never been a time where they've been integrated in the community. So there's no real such thing as rehabilitation, because they've never been habilitated in the first place. Okay. From the time they were very young, whether they're rich criminals or poor criminals, they've had a very specific sociopathic kind of outlook on people and on how to get what they want. And the only way he was able to change many of them, more than therapy does, because he discovered that in therapy, the criminal just used the system. He just milked it, abused it, and exploited it for what he wanted. But he discovered by getting them to change their thoughts, literally, which was a rigorous program of writing down everything they thought, analyzing it, and literally re-inputting thoughts until that became habitual. That was the only way that he could affect a change on someone. And perhaps for the rapist, and I despise that kind of individual, despise, since I'm a huge advocate of women's rights all over the world. I mean, the idea of a man brutalizing a woman like that just, it drives me insane. And a child molester, if they were subjected to a program like that that changed their thoughts, maybe then I would trust them in the community. I don't know what's stigmatizing them, if that it gives them enough awareness that other people are around them and shouldn't be their victims, that they stop doing what they're doing, or if it just goes underground. But I'd definitely love to know if it works.
It's so hard for me to grasp how, when I see child molesters on TV, like being dramatized or so, I can't understand it. I can't understand, because they always are portrayed really evil people. Whereas I would assume that all child molesters perhaps aren't evil. I'm not sure that people can be born evil, or perhaps everybody are born evil. I'm not sure.
Irrespective of what their experiences are, they're responsible for their behavior. You know, I don't care. I don't care what people think. You can think anything. Thinking is not a sin. But the second you take action on something that dark, you are evil to me. And I'm not, I don't care about your origins. I don't care about your story. That I'll leave that to the psychiatrist to suss it out, and that'll be between you and him. What I care about is that you've harmed a child, and you need to be punished for it. Or you've harmed a woman, you brutalized a woman, and you need to be punished for it. Just like it may be very interesting for Alice Miller, you know, the great psychologist, to analyze dictators like Hitler and Shiseku and monsters like that. And I find it interesting to read what she writes about them, but frankly, they need to be stopped. And I don't care that he had a terrible relationship with a domineering mother and a terrible father. I had, you know, issues in my life similar to that. And I haven't decided to demonize a population of human beings and murder millions of people for it.
What did you just say? You had what kind of experiences?
Well, my stepfather was had pretty serious problems. And, you know, I grew up with him from the time I was about 3 to 15 when my mom finally divorced him. And he was an alcoholic. And he wasn't a nice person to begin with. I look back on it now and I think that he had PTSD because he was a Marine in World War II, and he had been through some of the worst battles in the Pacific. He was in Midway, and he was in Guadalcanal, and he was 19 years old at the time. So he was a witness to things that no human being should be a witness to, and at an age when it was impossible for him to really deal with it. And I think he came back with that, and being a man of that time, never sought help for it, and medicated by drinking alcohol and acting out. And he was a very mean, rageful drunk. Mean to my mother, mean to me. I don't think he liked me at all. And that was my experience growing up, coming home from school every day with a knot in the pit of my stomach, dreading that I would have to now go home and wondering what I was going to have to confront that day or that night, you know. Yeah. And it was a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. And he shackled me with that. You know, he gave me that PTSD, and he gave me that kind of fear that is like at the deepest levels, you know, that, and that was my inheritance from him. But I've chosen to go to therapy and to work it out and to understand myself and to differentiate between him and I, and to know that I have worth separate from him, and to not act out in ways that are antisocial. So it's not that I don't have sympathy for somebody's story, but I have more sympathy for the person they've harmed.
When you spoke about this, I'm going to try a thought with you now, that I myself might be appreciating a person's free will. I mean, if you abuse my free will, if you would press me down to the floor, and you don't even have to rape me, but if you would sort of violate my right to be a free person, I would say that that might be a worse crime than if you would kill me, because I don't know what's going to happen after death.
Right.
That might be a liberation. You might be doing me the best favor ever, and perhaps murdered people have a great time in the afterlife. You never know.
I wish I believed in that afterlife thing, but you're you're right in the sense that a person who gets victimized like that now has to live with the scars of what that person's given them for the rest of their lives. Just like people like me who grew up in abusive households have to live with that and contend with that forever, and it changes you, for sure. I mean, there's probably a reason that the penalties for rape were so much stiffer in this country in the early part of the 20th century than they've become. I'm not necessarily against that. I mean, it might have even been a death penalty offense at one time in this country. Maybe that's a little excessive, but I feel so strongly about the use of force against innocent people that I can sympathize with why you would say it's, we got to execute this guy for what he's done to this poor woman or this poor child.
When you went to therapy, I guess that was that a long period of your life?
I went to therapy from the time I was 16 into my 40s.
Okay, all right.
So various kinds of therapy. And I've always sought teachers in my life. Since I never really had a father figure, I think I gravitate towards mentors, and I've always been curious about people, and so I've satisfied that curiosity by reading a lot and connecting with people that I think know more than me, and these people challenge me. They challenge me.
I haven't done that much therapy, but my assumption of it is that you get sort of tools to cope with stuff. Could you tell me, like, to become free of your stepfather or to sort of separate, perhaps he's going to haunt you in some ways for the rest of your life, but could you tell me about some of the tools you were given?
I think one of the tools is to first off recognize it, because I think what people do as a defense mechanism is they deny. They deny, deny, deny. They live in a state of denial. And that denial becomes a state of disowning, where you disown parts of yourself that you find distasteful, or parts of yourself that you don't want to be conscious of because they're too painful. So the first part of therapy, I think, is to become aware of it. And once you become aware of it, not to deny it. And that direct confrontation with your feelings, with your demons, with your past, that acknowledgement of what it is for what it is, just in and of itself is extremely therapeutic. If you never went past that, you would be much freer than you were. Because I don't think you ever outgrow it. I think it's always there. And even if it's just a tiny resonance, it's always there. It always informs you, sometimes at the worst times. But then the second part of that, I think, is to then grieve. I think grieving is a very important part of the process, because we want so badly to frame our childhood positively, because these people were our universe. You know, we associate our sense of life with our parents, I think, and to admit that not only were they not perfect, but they were horrible, that they didn't love you. To not be loved by, you know, your parent and to acknowledge that is a terrible kind of awareness. But embracing it and allowing yourself to grieve over it is another step towards being healthy. And then after that, it's about, you know, separating yourself from them and understanding when the voices you're hearing in your head are your own and helpful and good for your life, or the damaging surrogate parent voices in your head that you've learned to parent yourself in the kind of malignant way that your parents, you know, taught you. So you learn to... You learn to separate that out and be a better parent to yourself, I think.
You're an actor. You are politically informed. You seem to take care of yourself physically and so forth. Given the fact about your background, do you think you would have had the life you've had if it wasn't for the abuse and so forth?
I wonder, you know, I mean, I think it's a good thing that we humans can put our terrible experiences into a kind of perspective that turns them around and makes them positive and productive for us. And I could say that if I didn't have these experiences, I wouldn't feel this way about people. I wouldn't feel so strongly about their right to be what they want to be. I wouldn't be sensitive in my work. I wouldn't be open to or vulnerable to other people like I am now. And that could be true. And I think that's a very productive way of using, you know, a really damaging past and using it in a way that works for you. I do think that, you know, to the extent that you're neurotic, and neurotic because you've experienced really horrible things in your life, you're cut off a little bit. So there's also the part of me that feels like there's still, even at my age, parts of my being that are alien and foreign to me, or that I'm unfamiliar with or afraid to touch because of what I experienced in my life. And the good thing about acting is that it kind of forces you to go there, you know, and acting on certain projects can become very spiritually invigorating. They can actually expand your growth and force you into areas that you wouldn't ordinarily go emotionally. And it can become kind of therapeutic. So I think I wonder if I would have become an actor otherwise.
You were sort of casted often as a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you grew up with one. Does that have to do with each other?
I wonder. I've thought about that a little bit. You know, I've wondered if it's that people's first impression of me has anything to do with something that my stepfather stamped on my face or on my soul that is like something that I can't get away from. And so that people automatically feel a sense of unease around me just because I give off something that I learned from an early age. And I don't know, but I think the characters that I play are a little more complex in the sense that I've noticed something in a number of them. They, even if they go about getting what they want in a way that's inappropriate or even bad, they are fighting for something noble. They're just out of their depth. Or even if it's a guy like Lucifer, I feel like a guy like Lucifer, a being like Lucifer, I feel like in the mythology of that show, he was going for something justified. And it's revenge, but I like revenge stories a little bit. Mm. Dogville was one of my favorite movies, and that's a good revenge story. There's something to be said for the self-esteem of somebody who is not going to take it anymore and decides to, you know, get what is due him. So,
but you were sort of saying in passing that people might not recognize you as a good person. I mean, but do you mean yourself, you privately?
Well, I mean, yeah, definitely I don't deny my demons, so I know that I have tons of dark side in me, and I've definitely done my share of sinning, for sure. But it never ceases to amaze me the amount of feedback I get from people where their immediate impression of me is one thing, but once they start talking to me, they have an entirely different impression of me. So that at first, people tend to be intimidated by me, and I forget that, oh, I'm 6'3", and I'm kind of big, and, you know, and I'm not wearing my glasses, I might look, like, frightening, or something about my face might look frightening, but inside is something benevolent, you know, and actually doesn't like to hurt anybody, and that's part of my philosophy, is that, you know, if you got to hurt somebody, they have to have done something wrong to you, or to, you know, somebody else, but so...
How does boxing come into that?
Well, I think, you know, it comes from, you know, being beat up on as a child by somebody who is so much bigger than you and feeling like you need to defend yourself against some folks. And look, when I'm in the ring, I don't have the killer instinct. I'm not a animal. I don't like harming people. I usually fight very defensively and only to the extent that somebody's trying to hurt me. If I get that sense that they're not working with me and learning with me, that they're actually, it's about who's the bigger man in there, then it becomes me protecting myself. But I'm not a fighter. I remember one time I was training at a famous kickboxing gym called the Jet Center, and I trained with a great, great Israeli martial artist. His name was Shuki Ron. And he learned Muay Thai in the Netherlands, which is one of the greatest places to learn Muay Thai next to Thailand. And I did this very seriously. I didn't fight, but I did the workouts and worked with him. And he trained a couple of world champions. And one day he looked at me when I walked into the gym, and the light heavyweight champion of the world was shadowboxing in the mirror. And he said, "Mark," he said, "you can beat him." But I couldn't. And here's why. Not just because I said I couldn't, but yeah, I probably had the technique and the strength and the youth and stuff to beat him on paper. But there's something in that guy that I don't have. And that something in that guy, to me, is like there is a meanness that he's in touch with that I'm not. There's just a desire to damage another human being that I don't have. That whenever I've gotten into a fight in real life, I've been terrified for myself, terrified of hurting the other person. And fighters that I know don't have that sensation. Or if they do, it's twisted in a way that it's a proactive, like, lusty desire to kind of put the other, you know, to dominate the other person. I don't have that. And so that's why I never took it beyond, you know, sparring in the ring, you know, just to learn how to do it.
Okay. Do you still do that, or is it just boxing now?
I don't box. I mean, I do the boxing workout, but yeah. I don't box anymore. Okay. I have equilibrium issues and stuff now, so I can't really get hit in the head anymore.
All right. Okay. I still haven't asked you a single question that I wrote down.
We're going into deep water here. It's been great. I like conversations like this.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Just one more question about politics, sort of, because I was wondering if you would be the president, would America be involved in wars?
Well, we wouldn't be involved in the wars that we're currently in, if that's what you mean. I don't think that America has had a concerted or unified, principled foreign policy in decades and decades and decades. And when they did, it was a kind of Wilsonian progressive policy of democratization and spreading democracy through the world through violence. And I disagree with that fundamentally. But that's been that premise has more or less dictated our involvement in every war since then. For me, as the president, I would have a self-interested foreign policy. And for those of you out there listening who think that we operate according to that premise now, you are, I hate to tell you, dead wrong. We don't. We have a self-sacrificial policy where we think we're entitled to go into a country, democratize it. In other words, push in institutions of democracy, which then enable the people to vote in governments that are hostile to us. And not only hostile to us, but support groups that are murderous in their intentions. And so as from my point of view, being the guy that believes that force is only appropriate when it's retaliatory force, I would only fight with those who attacked us. But I would fight without apology until the threat is done. There wouldn't be any sense of let's contain it, let's limit it and contain it. If you have a cancer, the idea is to cut it out, not to keep it in your body, but to eliminate it entirely. Because if it's still there, it's going to metastasize. And I think in World War II, which frankly is our involvement is questionable. There were probably other alternatives in hindsight that we could have used that would have probably more effectively ended the concept of authoritarianism, but we didn't because our government was slightly authoritarian as well. But at least in World War II, they understood that we were fighting ideas first. We were fighting principles first. We were fighting Nazism. We weren't fighting the Panzer units. Those were just techniques, just like terrorism is a technique used by somebody animated by a philosophy. And in the Pacific Theater, we were fighting Japanese imperialism that was motivated by a Bushido philosophy. And we understood that we had to take that philosophy and show the people that believed it that it was wrong, that it was not only wrong, it was evil and had no place in a civilized world between human beings. It had to be humiliated and destroyed utterly, discredited in the eyes of its own people. And unfortunately, that took a lot to do, a lot that people look back on, and myself included, and say, well, that's horrible. That's horrible what happened. Yes, it is horrible, but it was a choice. It was a no-win situation.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That the non-aggressive powers were forced into. They had to defend themselves. And had we defended ourselves in the way that we do it today, Nazism would still be alive. It would still be fomenting. It would still be agitating. It would still be causing wars somewhere in the world. And so would the Shinto religion. And so would Bushido and those principles that animated the generals and admirals in the Japanese army. Those would still be powerful forces that we'd have to contend with for decades and decades and decades and decades. Instead, we outright eliminated them. We said these ideas have no place in human society. No place. And I think they were right.
To use the atomic bomb.
When we were put in this position, and this is a very controversial position that I've tweeted from time to time, I've argued with many people over it. We were given a choice. The choice was to kill 100,000 people or 1.5 million people. By all estimates at the time, our going into Japan would have meant a million or more allied American and or allied forces probably would have died along with the Japanese forces. Now, people say their military was paralyzed at the time. They were completely they were not a viable military force. But by all accounts that I've ever known, the people were willing to fight because their emperor had not given up. And that meant house-to-house warfare, island-to-island warfare. So the decision was a terrible one. And it's a terrible one that we were forced into. And regrettable in the sense that we were even put in the position to have to do that in the first place. But from my point of view, if somebody is the aggressor, they can't make the terms. You make the terms defending yourself. You make the terms and you go until the person stops. You go until the threat is over. Now, that seems sensible to me, but it doesn't seem sensible to most people nowadays, and I don't understand why. Maybe you can tell me why that doesn't seem sensible.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I agree. On the other hand, my knowledge about World War II, since A, I'm a little bit young, B, I'm ignorant, C, or all of the above. But anyway, I'm not sure. But then it's fairly safe to say that you're not a pacifist then.
I'm not a pacifist. I think pacifism is even evil. If you don't believe that retaliatory force is moral. The pacifist, in my view, and maybe you have listeners that could argue with me and passionately and well, pacifism to me holds all force as morally the same, as all force is aggressive, is aggression. And I disagree fundamentally. There is a difference between the guy who breaks into my house to rape my wife or take what I have, and me defending myself against him. There's a difference between those two kinds of force, yet they are both force. And so there is a difference in my mind between what the Allied powers did to defend itself against two authoritarian cultures and what those authoritarian cultures did. And that, to me, is the difference. It's everything. It's everything. It makes the Allied side moral in their use of force. And it makes the casualties that happened as a result of that overwhelming force the responsibility of the government that aggressed. It's not my fault when somebody breaks in here and I shoot him. It's his fault. That never would have happened had he not done what he did. And none of that would have happened. None of those actions would have happened, from the firebombing of Dresden, all these horrible things at Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. None of that would have happened had they not aggressed. None of that would have happened had they not marched through China, murdering people in Indonesia, murdering them for resources. I mean, the savagery of both sides of the Axis powers is almost unimaginable. And I think in comparison, even though there's nothing really good about war, war is a state, it's a state that has to be stopped. It's a state under which no human being can survive. It's terrible. There's no denying it. But please make a distinction between retaliatory force and aggression. Those are not the same things. There's a moral difference between the two, and the moral difference is everything.
There are people in Sweden who think that we should, and I might agree, that we, since we are such a small nation, and nowadays we talk again, as we did when I was a child, about the Russians being a threat to Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that if we would sort of, what do you call it, like strengthen the army and so
military,
forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically to burn money. Because if the Russians decide to invade Sweden, we're not going to stand a chance anyway. So we might as well just stop, like, making an excuse for them to fight us. Because if they want to take us, well, come take us then. That I would like to sort of, for us to just lay down on the ground when the armored cars come rolling in.
Well, then you may not be thinking that 10 years down the line, if Sweden is a satellite of Russia and you're subjected to the same kinds of things that their government subjects their own people to. I mean, for me, life isn't worth living unless you're free. And I know that there's really no free countries around. I know not in the way that I think there should be. We're all subjected to force from our governments who are supposedly doing things for our own good. You know, that's a whole other can of worms to open. But we're basically free. We have basic freedoms, you know, and there are some pillars of Western civilization that are alive in even, you know, countries that are predominantly socialistic. And to have those stolen from you, to have your intellectual freedom taken away, to have your property taken away from you, is taking your life, because your life is your property. I don't just mean the material things around you, but it's the things you earn, your body, your mind, all of this is your property that is yours. It's nobody else's unless you willingly decide to give those things to somebody else. Otherwise, to the extent that somebody is entitled to it or can have control of it, you're a slave. And I would rather die in the streets of Stockholm with a gun in my hand, shooting at the man that wants to take that from me and from my friends and from the people that I love, than to lay down and let them bulldoze over me and control our society in the way that they feel they control theirs.
I totally agree that freedom is essential and super important. However, I think that if we would try to use force against the Russians, would they invade us? We're just harming ourselves.
Yeah, in the short term, but for a long-term gain, you make them pay for every foot of ground that they take, as opposed to letting them just come in and take over. You're fighting for something that is the most noble cause in humanity, and that's for liberty.
When this person comes running in through the door here to rape us, the two of us, if that person makes me shoot him, if I shoot that person, he fucks up my life anyway, because it would be a really hard thing to live with.
You're right, but not as much as he would have had he victimized you.
I'm not sure. Perhaps it's better to be raped, if I would be raped, than to live with the conscience of killing someone.
Well, I mean, I understand. To me, of course, taking a life would be extremely difficult. But what would help me put it into a moral terms is what they did. It's what they did that prompted the action that you took. And so, as difficult as it is, it's probably far better than living with the scars of what they would leave you with if they chose to let you live after that at all. Your life is in their hands, and they can do what they want with you. That's no place for a human being to be. So, you know, if this person were perverse enough to come in here and try to rape the two of us, first of all, he'd probably be surprised to see the two of us here. I'll help you out. I'll make sure that I don't let them do that.
So you'll kill him?
Well, look, I'll tell you a story real fast. I was in my apartment with my girlfriend at the time and my roommate. This is in early 90s. And I heard screaming coming from downstairs. And it sounded like a woman was being murdered. And that's what I thought was happening. So I grabbed my 45 and I went downstairs, my gun. I went downstairs and through one hallway came a man, and he was being followed by our property manager. And he had a screwdriver in his hand. He had been trying to trying to break into somebody's house. So I put my gun on him and I said, stop. And I had just been training with a teacher who trained special forces and SWAT guys. And I trained myself very thoroughly with the gun. So it wasn't like I didn't know what I was doing, like so many people who pull a gun out. And he took another step, and my girlfriend was watching from the balcony and said, don't do it, because he'll shoot you. Because that's what I learned. You know, I'm not going to pull it out unless I'm going to use it. And I made him sit on his hands, and I waited till the police came. And I did know that my life changed in that moment, because I felt if I had to, I would. And even though I didn't have to do anything, he had a weapon in his hand. And I was within my rights, because he was about where that wall is there. So I'm actually within my legal rights to use lethal force based on where he was, based on what he was doing. But I didn't have to, thank God. And this is the majority of cases that happen in the United States, where they claim that 200, you know, a million people use guns, you know, to protect innocent lives and property. So many of them don't get into the newspapers, in part because it's this moment where you make somebody sit down, you call the cops, they are not moving, they're not harming anybody anymore because you've stopped it just by your show of force. So yes, it would be terrible and life-changing, just like what we were talking about with war. Terrible, life-changing. But I'm forced into that position by what the other person is doing. I'm forced into that. I would never have had to make that choice had they not done what they did, if they just live and let live. Mm. And so that makes my action moral, because my only intent is to make them stop their aggression. And I had to do, I could do it without firing a shot with that guy. And if that ever happens in the future, I hope I could do it without harming anybody in the future. But if I have to, well, I stopped a rape one time. I literally stopped somebody from raping somebody, and I had to knock the guy unconscious. I had to punch him in the face and knock him out.
Oh, wow.
And people from their balconies were watching and not doing anything, not calling the police, not doing anything. It was like a circus sideshow. And it's not my fault that I hit him. I said, get off of her, and I had the police called, and he came at me. He attacked me. I was just trying to defuse the situation. So what happened to him is his fault. It's not mine. What happens to that guy who breaks in is his fault. It's not mine. He's at war with me by breaking into my place and saying that what is yours is mine by right, and I'm going to take it aggressively from you. By depriving me of my own reason, my own values, he has now stepped outside of what I think the purpose of society is, which is to not only just the passage of knowledge and division of labor and the expansion of knowledge, but protection.
Are you pro the Second Amendment? Some people think that you should sort of... Okay, all right, that's a T-shirt saying, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to
keep and bear arms
shall not be
infringed.
So, are you NRA?
I'm not.
Almost. Borderline NRA.
No, I think... I mean, I see what they're doing, but I think their justifications are so stupid that I can't really get behind them. And maybe a guy like Wayne LaPierre, or any of the president, whoever the current president of the NRA is, would be able to dispute me. But to say that an AK-47 or an AR-15 are hunting weapons is kind of a stupid justification. But I was here during the LA riots, and one of the images that is burned in my brain are from the Korean shops that were not burned down. And the reason they weren't looted or burned down was because the Korean store owners stood in front of their shops with AK-47s. For me, a weapon like that is for when the cops won't be there. It's for when the civil structure does break down and you're dealing with gangs of human beings that are criminals and want to harm you. And a revolver ain't going to help you, but a weapon like that will. And when I think of, you know, Switzerland, where every, I think, draft age person has a firearm, automatic weapon, whatever the caliber of the weapon is, they all have one.
Okay.
There's no gun violence. I think of my right to defend myself in the most efficient way possible, and my love of people and their right to defend themselves, women in particular, who are victims, overwhelmingly the majority of victims in violent crime. Oftentimes, the equalizer between her and that big dude that's trying to harm her is a firearm, or that alienated husband who, you know, has a restraining order against him but breaks into her house anyway. That's distasteful to a lot of people, I imagine, and seems contradictory that I hold such principles of love of humanity and liberty, and say that part of the protection of that is your ability to defend yourself as efficiently as possible. And that's what I think the Second Amendment does. It's just claiming a right to self-defense, and a right to self-defense against usually the biggest violator of human rights, which is government.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
Well, I disagree, of course. I'm Swedish. I think that would there be no firearms, there would be less violence, I guess, if you could erase all firearms from the face of Earth.
So I guess the Macedonian conquering of Egypt and parts of Asia Minor didn't have violence. They didn't have firearms. They just crucified people along the sides of the road. And
no, you're right. Of course.
I mean, history is splattered with not just individual violence, but gangs and hordes of people murdering and raping and enslaving entire civilizations before guns were even invented.
Of course, yeah. But I'm talking about now. I would assume that if there would be no firearms in America, there would be less murders.
And if there were no disease in the world, there would be no death. But I am dealing with the world as it is. and the world as it is, there are firearms. And either a law-abiding citizen who respects people and community is going to own one, or a person who is at war with the community and thinks that what they have is his by right is going to own one. And when we make these onerous gun laws, what we do is we take guns from the people who are law-abiding and productive citizens, and we disarm them, in essence, against these other people who have no sense of community or no sense of conscience and don't care who they harm. I'd rather be armed if somebody came into a theater. If some of these mass shootings, you know, that have happened over the last 5 years, they've happened in gun-free zones. How far do you think a person like that would get if people in the audience were armed? Not very far, one can imagine.
Yeah, perhaps.
There was a case of that woman in Texas where the guy, I think, bashed his car through a Denny's window and then got out and started shooting people in the restaurant. And he was, you know, right in the beginning of the spree where she was sitting. She had a clear shot at him, but left her gun in the car. Mm-hmm. And could have, you know, could have turned this mass murder spree, you know, of 10 or 15 casualties into, could have saved 13 lives.
In Sweden, we don't have any school shootings like the ones that have been here. Why do you think that almost only happens in America?
What was that one that just happened recently with that guy that went to that camp? You know which one I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. I thought he was Swedish.
So. That was in Norway, yeah.
In Norway.
That was absolutely horrible, yeah.
Absolutely horrible, yeah, of course. Well,
I think it was actually like 70 or something. Yeah.
I think that it's more appropriate to say, does gun ownership cause crime? And does it lead to these kinds of things? And I think that the overwhelming evidence shows it doesn't. I think the overwhelming evidence shows that when they enact concealed carry laws, crime goes down precipitously. And where I see tons of gun crime happening in my country, I see basically cities that are gun-free cities. Chicago has extremely strict gun ownership laws, probably the highest murder rate in the country at the moment, and most by gun violence. Mm-hmm. And all of those guns are procured by illegal means. It's the people like you and me walking down the street who are the victims of that stuff, or could become the victims of that, who are prevented from defending ourselves. So the principle to me is that if I see statistically that gun ownership in law-abiding people's hands actually lowers crime, then I don't hold gun ownership in and of itself as intrinsically bad. I hold the values of the people holding the firearm as either good or bad, not gun ownership itself. And I also see it as the most efficient means of protecting yourself. And as far as I'm concerned, your right to self-protection is sacrosanct. Nobody could violate that. Your life matters. It's the most important thing to you. Mm. And you should be allowed by our government, whose ostensible purpose is to protect you, to defend yourself, because the police won't be there when this stuff goes down. They won't. And there's times when, a number of times, even in just LA history, where civil disobedience has gone into the realm of violence, we see it in Ferguson too, and nobody will protect you. Nobody will protect you except you.
Well, we can't dwell more on politics. Perhaps we'll get back to it. But can I ask you, you said that you've done a lot of sinning.
Yes.
How? I mean, first of all, you're not religious, so how can you even sin?
Well, I mean, sin in the sense, well, sin, I think in this purest sense, means missing the mark, right? It's not. So for me, my philosophical orientation is that when I step outside the rational, I can act against my life. If I act against my life, whether it's drinking too much or, you know, on a habitual basis as opposed to just, you know, once a year, or if I were to do something to sabotage my career or friendship, these to me are sins, because you're acting against your interests, you're acting against your rational values. And one would call that irrational. And for me, that is a no-no in my philosophical world. Mm.
This is political. But since you think that, for instance, that I assume that you think that all drugs should be legal.
Yes.
Do you also think that prostitution should be legal?
Yes.
It is, perhaps. I'm not sure.
It's not, but it should be. It's legal in some counties, I think, around the United States, like in parts of Nevada, it's legal.
San Remo, right?
I don't know.
I'm not sure either, but I've heard that people go from Vegas to San Remo.
Oh, that's it, San Remo. Yeah. Maybe that's where it is, yeah.
Okay, never mind. So when did you find acting? When did you start acting?
I started when I was in my mid-20s. I stumbled into it by accident. I went to college for a year. I was a little disillusioned with it, and I dropped out. After a year, I got straight A's, but I dropped out. And just kind of...
What were your major?
At first, biology, and then I changed it to psychology and history. And then I started working at a gas station and seeing a crazy girl. My girlfriend at the time was kind of crazy, and just got lost in just, you know, being 19 and not knowing what I wanted to do. And at some point thought, well, I've got to do something more than this. And I signed up for a modeling class at a place called John Robert Powers. I didn't have to pay anything for it, so... But I thought, well, maybe I'll model or something.
Because you were a tall, handsome guy.
I was tall. I don't know about handsome, but I thought maybe I could do it. And I did a couple of gigs. I did a little runway and I did a catalog.
Were you athletic growing up?
Yeah, I was. I was. But I went through a kind of growth spurt late in life. So there was a period of time from like 15 to 18 where I wasn't as athletic. I used to do sports all the time, but... And so at this John Robert Powers place, I went into a commercial workshop, and the actor there who was teaching it thought I had talent, set me up with an agent, and that agent set me up with an acting school that turned out to be one of the best acting schools on the West Coast, and that just kind of started me off.
What was your first paid job as an actor?
My first paid job was a movie called Fatal Beauty, and I hadn't even... started taking acting class yet, so I had no idea how to approach what I was doing. But there were some big people in the movie. Whoopi Goldberg was in the movie, and that's when she was, you know, really on top of her game as far as acting goes. Sam Elliott was in it. Brad Dourif was in it. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I stumbled through that movie. It's probably the worst death scene. I gave the worst death scene probably in all of cinema because I had no idea how to die. But it was...
Do you think that's on YouTube? That would be cool to show the viewers.
You could probably get that, yeah.
Listeners, yeah.
I'm sorry. I apologize to your listeners in advance for that. If most of them haven't turned off because of our political conversation.
Well, I'm not sure. It has to pass my really aggressive editor, Lovisa, back in Sweden. So we'll see how much...
But those are the kinds of conversations that I love the most.
Well,
I'm like that guy that loves coming into a party and talking about politics and religion. But because I don't feel like I do it with anger, I'm not trying to push my thing on you. You're not trying to push your thing on me. And it's kind of cool. Like, we can exchange and disagree and be like, hey, it's okay.
How many guns do you own?
How many guns do I own? See, the fact that I have to think about it, you're like, okay. I think I own maybe 7.
All handguns?
No, I have 4 handguns, 2 shotguns.
What do you use them for? Protection?
Various, yeah. Well, target practice now just to keep myself... and I can't use it for protection unless I have a... concealed carry permit. I have to get a permit for those, which I do have. I don't have the permit. I have the form for the permit. So for now, they're in a safe, and they stay there till I go to the gun range, and then I use them on the gun range.
Do you ever hunt and stuff?
No, I hate that. I hate that.
Okay. You've been a working actor for how long? Like 20 years?
Yeah, 20 yeah. years, yeah.
I've sort of fallen in love with this question. I tend to ask it to most of my guests these days. But do you feel that you've reached your full potential?
No. No, God, no.
What's in the way?
Well, me. Usually that's me. And now that the system is kind of opening up, you know, now that studios don't necessarily have all of the control over what gets made and what doesn't get made, now that Netflix and Amazon and iTunes are actually backing films that have been made, giving them a wider distribution, it's easier now to participate in projects that can, you know, promote your talents a lot more than what you do out there in the world as it is now. But I've never put it on anybody else's head that I'm where I'm at because of other people. I'm where I'm at because of a combination of elements. You know, I'm some of it is, you know, it takes a while for people to see who you are, and some of it is that it takes you a while to let yourself be what you are. And I feel like I'm still growing into myself.
Do you have a mental bucket list?
I'd love to do the play Enemy of the People. Ibsen is one of my favorite playwrights, and I love that character. Dr. Eastman is an amazing character. Right up my alley, right up my value system, you know, and I'd love to do that at some point. And, you know, I just want to do good films that say what I want to say, because I think our culture is saturated with redos of old, old values that are not helping us. I want to participate in a revolution of culture. I think that's the artists. I think that I'm an aspiring artist. I don't consider myself an artist, but as an aspiring artist, I think I can be the barometer of truth and register my protest at things that I feel are hurting us. I think that's what a good artist or aspiring artist does, right?
Yeah. What do you have planned ahead? I mean, I know that it was just pilot season. Did you book any jobs?
I'm working actually on a show called The Returned.
I know that.
Yeah. So I've been on hiatus from that. And we'll find out hopefully in the next month or so if we get picked up for a second season. So I didn't do pilot season this year.
Okay.
Since my show is out. But I have been working on my own stuff. My wife just finished a series of international shorts that we did that are thematically connected, and it's going to become a feature film about miscommunication between cultures and the sexes. And they're comedies, and we just finished shooting that 2 weeks ago. And we've done that in 8 countries and 12 cities, and it's nice to see the photographic part of that finished. And now she's doing another project that I'm helping to produce called The Last Train, which is based on a play by a very, very good actor named Anthony Montez. And we'll have the effect of suicide prevention, I think. It's about that topic, and it's a really poignant story about two people. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how that's going to look on when it's all cut together. And other than that, I'm writing stuff, too, that I hope to put out there one day.
Do you call yourself a feminist?
Feminist in the sense that I believe in the equality of the sexes, the legal equality of the sexes, yeah.
I think actually, when I look at my script for this, I think we've actually touched everything.
Did we?
Yeah, I think so. So if there's not anything you would like to add about the stuff we've said already?
No, I liked this. I thought it was really interesting. I haven't had to talk about stuff like that in a public forum really ever. So it's nice that there's a space out there to be able to discuss really volatile topics like politics and really sensitive topics like where you've come from and what's going on inside of you in a free, open way. I really like that. I appreciate it, the time for it.
Thank you. For me, not being an American, it's so interesting to hear your thoughts about war, guns, and so forth. It's super interesting. I mean, I'm trying to sort of grasp the American society, and it's been like I've met a lot of people in showbiz, and they have a democratic sort of scope on everything. It seems like you come from a different angle and stuff.
I think I do. I don't think there's anything in the mainstream political world in America that I identify with. And maybe that's why it's interesting, because I'm not a party person. I'm not one that identifies with the left party or the right party. In fact, I think there's very few things on the right that I like, and some things more on the left in certain areas that I like. I just don't agree with their execution. And both sides, to me, don't respect individual rights. Both sides want to control what they think is important. And so for me, I'm outside of that loop. And I'm glad I'm able to give you like a different perspective, because I don't know that you will ever hear this perspective, especially from an actor. Maybe you will. Maybe there's some libertarian actors out there.
I draw the conclusion that you aren't really happy with President Obama.
I haven't been happy with the president since probably Lincoln.
Okay. All right. Would you like to recommend something? Anything?
Hey, well, I mean, I think one of my favorite philosophers, and this will totally alienate people, so it'll probably get edited out, no doubt. But one of my favorite philosophers is Ayn Rand, and I think one of the one of the greatest things she ever did was provide a clear system of ethics based on rational egoism. And it's so benign, and of course it gets maligned by everybody, most of whom don't read it. But if I could recommend a book, it would be, or an essay, it would be On Objectivist Ethics. And read it for yourself before you jump to conclusions about what rational egoism means, because it's in a book. It's the first essay of a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. And that title alone will alienate so many people, because they presume that it means selfishness means you get what you want at the expense of others. And she was the first person to define selfishness as not that at all. And that pursuing your own rational values in no way conflicts with other people pursuing theirs, and that you don't get what you want at somebody else's expense. And so to frame the moral argument in totally revolutionary terms, I think is essential for us as people. And to me, that's my New Testament. That's my standard of good. And if I can in some way contribute to getting it out there more to people, especially people who criticize her for whatever reasons they criticize her for, to read the ideas firsthand instead of secondhand or thirdhand, and to decide for themselves whether or not this truly is an expression of a benign, good moral value system.
Who do you think I should interview in my podcast?
I think you should interview Alex Epstein.
Okay.
Alex Epstein wrote a great book called, and I get this, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. You want to talk about something totally countercultural, and he's not in the pocket of the oil guys. The oil guys are running from him like crazy. But he communicates the most articulate message that I've ever heard about why it is good to use coal and oil.
Uh-huh.
Why it is good. And I guarantee that's not in our mainstream. That's not what we hear. We've been hearing for decades that it's horrific. But he'll show you a different tune, and he may even convince you by the time the interview is over.
Cool. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, man. It's been great.
Mr. Mark Pellegrino, ladies and gents. And if you do want to follow him on Twitter, he's Mark or Pellegrino there. And I, for instance, am Varvetpod. And speaking of which, you can check out our homepage at varvetpod.net. And if you want to discuss the content, why don't you do so on Instagram, for instance, and we're Varvetpod there as well. Varvet is made by me, Christopher Triumph, and editor Lovisa Olsson, and producer Christina Jörling Biro. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye, and thank you, Acast, for distribution!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.